Just to be clear, the joke he meant was that in Finnish, Ravi is apparently like a horse cart race, where the horses trot and not gallop. But I'm going to gallop through this talk, so let's just begin. Welcome to CCOSA. I've been rooting for this acronym for this conference, but no one likes it. It helps me remember the name: contextuality, conceptual issues, operational signatures, and applications. So we've had a lot of debate about conceptual issues right from day one, for example, between Rob and Adan and everything. Today is about operational signatures, more or less. And I am also going to talk about operational signatures. This talk is not an experimental talk. It's a theory talk, but it's about how to come up with good operational signatures that an experimentalist can go and test. Okay. So this is the outline of my talk. Broadly, it's in three parts. From here to here is just definitions, giving you the framework. Okay. Then we'll go beyond the Cauchon-Speckle theorem. This is the second part, how to do it for uncolorable scenarios. This is the third part, how to do it for colorable scenarios. And then final remarks. OK, background. Friends, humans, contextuality, men and women, lend me your ears. I come here not to praise Speckens. I speak not to disprove what Adan spoke. But here I am to speak what I do know. By which I mean that I'm not going to engage in the conceptual issues and debates we've already engaged in. What I'm trying to do in this talk is to ask, if you take the notion of non-contextuality that Rob has been working on, has defined, and which I quite like, I'm not praising him, I'm praising his notion. I'm just saying, if you take that notion seriously, where does that take you? Okay? In particular, when we're talking about okay, so of course, the things I do know begin with this framework. That's due to Rob. So this talk is about what does that framework say for the types of experiments that people thinking about the Cauchon-Speckle theorem usually conceptualize. Okay, the notion itself is more broadly applicable. For example, the experiment that Mike talked about is not a Cauchon-Speckle experiment, but we still call it a contextuality experiment because it's that sort of an experiment within Rob's framework. But this talk is about other kinds of experiments, the kinds of experiments you're usually interested in when you're thinking about Bell and Cauchon-Speckle scenarios. Okay? So the first observation, we know that Cauchon-Speckle non-contextuality and POVMs don't go well together. Right? This was something that Giulio mentioned in his talk, that somehow if you allow POVMs, the hierarchy between classical quantum and post-quantum correlations just breaks down because trivial POVMs can realize any quantum model at all. Okay, we'll see a concrete example of this later on. So there are two options you can take now, right? One is you hold on to your notion of classicality, which is Cauchon-Speckle non-contextuality, and you just, by fiat, restrict the set of measurements to which you apply it, where it makes sense, which is projective measurements. Or if you're talking about GPTs, with Giulio's definition, you can now talk about sharp measurements. Right? So that's the first option that, for example, Adan would advocate. Option two, so I'm just talking about logical possibilities. The second option is you broaden your notion of classicality. Right? So you notice that your notion of classicality did not work for POVMs very well. So you're like, oh, I have two options. Either I can restrict the set of measurements to which I apply to it, or I broaden my notion of classicality to make sense of POVMs. So I'm going to talk about this second option, which is about broadening the notion of classicality to Speckens non-contextuality, and we do not place any restriction on the set of measurements. In particular, I need to make no statements about what a sharp measurement is or what an unsharp measurement is. Okay, it's just a measurement. Now, so we take the latter approach. The revised notion of non-contextuality, as I mentioned, is Speckens. And of course, whenever we say trivial POVMs are classical, thinking about Cauchon-Speckle non-contextuality, that's not really a meaningful statement in terms of Cauchon-Speckle non-contextuality, because if they give you maximal violations in a way, right? So what's that intuitive idea? What we're really saying is that these are trivial in the sense that if you throw different input states to them, they do not give you different statistics. They're just insensitive to the state. They're multiples of identity, basically, right? It doesn't matter what state you throw at them, they always give you the same distribution. That's the sense in which they are classical. And in some sense, we'll make this notion quantitative in this talk. Okay? The most relevant prior work for this talk is this paper, where this is where this whole project started. And this is related work. The first of this is published. The other three is like backlog from a year or 2 years now. It should be out like next week. All three of them on three different days. I just have to decide the order. Okay. So let's begin. So we're talking about an experiment and its descriptions. That's what we are working with. The kind of experiment we are thinking of, most generally speaking, is a prepare and measure experiment, where you have two boxes, a source, a measurement. The source has possible choices of inputs. These are some classical labels for the source setting. These S, this S is the set of all labels. Okay, you choose an input to the source. It prepares an ensemble of preparations, like the system has prepared an ensemble of states. And each element of that ensemble is labeled by the outcome of the source. So the small s labels which element of the ensemble is prepared in that particular run when you see this outcome. Okay, and then this element is sent to the measurement device. And on the measurement device, you choose a measurement setting, which is your choice of measurement, the measurement you want to implement on that input in the input system. And then you observe some measurement outcome, right? So this is just a very simple schematic for a prepare and measure experiment. And this is just the abstract description. There are no probabilities here in Julio's words. He's not here, but I was trying to make my slides sort of appeal to him by being more precise about a lot of definitions. So I've not put in any probabilities yet, okay? The thing we are interested in here is the behavior of these outputs given these inputs, right? And what we're talking about is the first kind of description of this experiment is in terms of an operational theory. In Julio's words, it would be an operational probabilistic theory. Because when he says an operational theory, he means in the abstract without any probabilities. But whenever I use the word, I mean I am assuming probabilities as well. Okay, so operational primitives. So the primitives of an operational theory are just the operations. They're not anything deeper. They're about what you do in the lab, the interventions you make, and the predictions you make based on those interventions. And that's encapsulated in this object, which is the probability of the outputs of that experiment given the inputs you put into that experiment. So the most minimal, the most minimal thing that quantum, you could call it an interpretation if you're strictly an operationalist, is operational quantum theory, where you make no claims about what's inside those boxes, and you just care only about input-output relations, right? Of course, we'll introduce more structure as we go along, so this will become more meaningful. The second kind of description of the same experiment is where the primitives are not what you're doing in the lab, but what is the thing that you're doing, whatever you're doing to in the lab, right? That thing is the ontic state, the system. How do you represent the states of the system? So we assume that there is some physical state associated with the system, which is independent of the agent, okay? And the goals are explanatory in this sense, that the operational predictions, the things I see, are reproduced by this ontological model in terms of these response functions for the measurement event, like given that this ontic state was prepared, and this is the distribution over that ontic state being prepared and the classical output of the source setting. Okay, this you can of course factorize further as lambda given that particular element of the source ensemble times the probability that that element is prepared. Okay, so this is roughly speaking, you could think of Bohmian mechanics as an instance of an ontological model for operational quantum theory as quantum information people use it. Right? So another thing. Things we are always assuming we can do in an experiment, okay? So I'm taking these definitions for granted again, okay? That preparation procedures can be mixed probabilistically to define a new preparation procedure. So for example, I can coarse grain over the outcomes of a source setting to define an averaged mixed state of sorts, right? Like this is, I'm just ignoring all the outcomes, just summing over everything, right? So I can always do this. So somehow I've already assumed this when I described the experiment to you. Okay, that measurement events from a given measurement procedure can be post-processed. So I'm defining new measurements by post-processing what I've already done in the lab. Okay, these post-processings are not things I'm doing in the lab. These are things I'm inferring from what I've done in the lab. Okay, a fine-grained measurement can be post-processed in many different ways to define post-processed measurements. In particular, like coarse grainings would be the case where these properties are always one and they map to some other common outcome. Okay. Now, second assumption, depends on your preference. I'm going to just say that this is a mathematical fact that we're going to use. In the operational description, we are assuming that whenever, like Mike was saying, whenever you choose I'm of course abstractly saying that the source is choosing the outcome with a certain probability, but we are assuming that when I implement the mixture with certain probabilities, the same probabilities are expected in the operational theory. Okay? And I'm making that assumption also for the measurements, that whenever I do a post-processing, it's represented like this in the operational theory. I'm also assuming this in the other description. These are two descriptions. In the other description as well, I'm assuming that for all ontic states, the distribution over this coarse-grained source is the average of these more fine-grained distributions. Okay? And similarly for the measurements. Okay? So we're taking these facts for granted. What we'll not presume in this framework is this assumption of outcome determinism, that the measurement in my ontological model responds deterministically to the ontic state. Okay? Now, so of course, if I had assumed this, if you were a skeptic, you would say, what operational grounds do you have for assuming that? Why should you assume? And then you could say, oh, I just believe in outcome deterministic ontological models. They're the interesting ones. That's what I want to test. It's exactly analogous to the previous argument, which was about, preparation non-contextuality. Is it interesting or not? So it's a matter of choice. Here we are deciding to abandon this assumption. Okay? Now, features of the operational description that are necessary to define non-contextuality. So far I gave you a description, the language in which I'm going to talk. Now I'm going to define what features this language should satisfy for me to be able to define a notion of non-contextuality. The first feature, of course, is operational equivalence. Because in this approach, without operational equivalence, we have no grounds for applying the assumption of non-contextuality. Okay? So source events, for example, two events so a source outcome given choice of measurement setting is equivalent to another source outcome for some other choice of measurement setting. We call them operationally equivalent if there is no measurement setting that I can choose, which will give me different output given input statistics for that operational experiment, for that experiment. Similarly, we'll call just the source settings themselves. So sometimes we'll just substitute sources for source settings. We'll call them operationally equivalent. So these are the average sources. When, if you ignore their outcomes, which means you sum over their probabilities, the outcome probabilities of the source, no measurement even can distinguish them. So this is our notion of operational equivalence. Mathematically, it just means this, that two events are operationally equivalent if the output given input statistics does not vary with the choice of the measurement setting. And similarly, for the coarse-grained sources, we have the same definition. Measurement events, we call them operationally equivalent if your operational theory doesn't allow for a source event that can distinguish them. That is, for all choices of source settings and outputs, the output given input relation in the operational theory is sort of unchanged for a fixed measurement. For the two different measurement events, they look the same. So now we can define a context, okay? So I needed that language to define what operational equivalence was. Now I also need to be able to define what a context is. So whenever I use the word context, I mean any distinction between operationally equivalent procedures. If you have two ways of doing the same thing, when I say the same thing, I mean that the operational statistics is the same. Then if there are certain features of the experiment that tell you that actually in the lab you're doing something that's slightly different, that's a part of the context, because it makes no difference to the operational statistics. Okay? That's what we call a context. We have defined this equivalence relation in the operational theory, and now we are saying within this equivalence class, if there are other differences, then those are differences of context, because they make no difference to the operational predictions. Examples, preparation context. Simply speaking, in quantum theory, these are different realizations of a given quantum state. Okay? The one that we mostly use is this one, where you can mix different sets of states to produce the same mixed state. Right? These are two different preparation contexts for the same equivalence class, which is the density matrix describing the operational predictions that you'll see in a different lab, in a lab. And of course, you can also think of purifications like that if you wanted to. We don't use it in this talk, but in principle, that's also a context. Okay? Measurement context, different realizations of a given POVM element, or a POVM element. So for example, in quotient specker, 1967, for example, the same projector appearing in different measurement bases is an example of like different contexts for the same projector, right? Joint measurability of context for a given POVM, for example. I mean, in the case of projective measurements, this is just the set of other operators it commutes with. Okay, And another notion of context, which is allowed in Rob's definition but not in the traditional definition, is, for example, different ways of implementing a fair coin flip experiment. You can do it in many different ways. And this paper is based on sort of an assumption of measurement non-contextuality applied to that example. Okay. So now that we have the definitions we need, well, I still haven't defined non-contextuality. I've told you what the context is, what an operational theory is. So non-contextuality is an inference from one description to the other description. The first description was the operational description. Second description was the ontological description. Now you want to relate these two. Like, in what sense does this description explain that one, right? So non-contextuality is an inference of that sort. Okay. So of course, as always, Leibniz tells us that we should not postulate any differences if we don't see any differences. So if there exists no operational way to distinguish two things, and for anyone, not just for like a particular agent, but for any agent working with that operational theory, then they must be physically identical. The idea being that, you know, if in principle you cannot tell using your operational theory two procedures apart, then in your second description, which is a deeper description and at the level of the ontological model, you should really assume that they're the same. Okay, it's an assumption. It's not a fact. So equivalently, it may sound more appealing in the contrapositive that if two things are really physically distinct, they're really different, right? There's no, like, if you really postulate they're physically distinct, then there must exist an operational way to distinguish them. Otherwise, what does it mean to say that they're physically distinct, right? If I can't do an experiment to tell them apart, then in what sense are they physically distinct? Okay, so that's the assumption of non-contextuality. So measurement non-contextuality, whenever you observe this operational equivalence between two measurement events, you assume that they're represented identically in the ontological model. Okay? That the response functions are identical for all input states, ontic states to the measurement device. Preparation non-contextuality is of the same flavor of assumption. If you believe in this, you have to hold this also like on principle, because this is your sort of principle that if things are indiscernible operationally, they must be indiscernible. They must be identical at the ontological level. So preparation non-contextuality says that if I observe operational equivalence at the level of source events or the coarse grain sources, then at the ontological level, the distributions associated with them must be identical. Because if there are differences here, then somehow they get coarse grained in a way that I don't see them here. And that's, in some sense, a very conspiratorial explanation. So in that sense, you're trying to motivate this as a natural explanation for the observed operational equivalences. Okay? Note that in all this, we have not needed a definition of a sharp measurement. Okay? All measurements are treated on an equal footing in this approach. And we need to do that because, as I was trying to motivate it for you initially, we need to be able to handle things like POVMs, right? In the particular case of quantum theory. We're not even assuming quantum theory, okay? Quotient-Speckle theorem. So the logic of the Quotient-Speckle theorem in terms of the language I have defined for you is this, that if you have certain operational equivalences between measurements, in particular measurement events for the classic Quotient-Speckle argument, if you assume measurement non-contextuality for those measurement events, that you assign the same distributions for all ontic states, and you assume outcome determinism, the idea that the measurement event responds deterministically to the outcome, to the input, then you get a contradiction, that these three assumptions are not are jointly contradictory. One of them must fail, right? So you have different options. So this is, of course, an operational fact. This is something you're supposed to verify in an experiment, OK? It's only once you have done that you can decide between these competing hypotheses about the ontological model, because this is not experimentally accessible to you. This is something you're hypothesizing. So now, if you have a contradiction, you should note that the contradiction would disappear if I relax the assumption of outcome determinism, which means indeterminism offers me a way out of this contradiction, right? And all this while, I've been saying that I don't want to assume this. So what should I do, right? Clearly, just these two on their own are not going to give me a contradiction, right? So let's just look at an example of the Quotient-Speckle theorem. I know, presumably everyone knows, but I just included it. In any case, so this is the 18-ray proof of the Quotient-Speckle theorem. Every measurement, so this is a measurement. These are four measurement outcomes. So there are 9 such measurements. Each measurement has 4 outcomes. And each outcome appears in 2 different measurement bases, right? So this is what we are saying. The probability of a certain projector occurring for a given basis, say this basis, for some choice of state, is the same as the probability of that projector appearing in the other basis, for the same choice of state, and this is true for all states, right? This is what quantum theory says, that this is the operational equivalence that you have in quantum theory if you're giving a quantum description of this experiment. Quotient spec and non-contextuality would say that the response functions you associate with these things are the same. Furthermore, they also are deterministic, right? So you assume that. Now let's call the values you assign to these guys W1 to W18, okay? W1, W2, W3, you just go like that up to W18, okay? For a certain ontic state, it assigns certain outcomes to all the measurements, okay? Now you ask yourself, what are the constraints on these value assignments? So this is just this system of 9 equations. These are just normalization equations. You see, if you ask for solutions in Z2, like Z0, 1 valued solutions, there is no solution, right? That's a straightforward contradiction. So now you know that if you postulated these assumptions, measurement non-contextuality and outcome determinism, given those operational equivalences, then these assumptions are just jointly contradictory. So there are no non-contextual assignments, okay? Every probabilistic model, every assignment of probabilities on this hypergraph is non-classical by the lights of quotient spec and non-contextuality. That's something you should recognize, okay? So by which I mean that if I don't restrict these to be 0, 1 valued, if I allow them to be probabilities, you do have a solution, obviously, right? Because then these are just fractions. So not all measurement. So the thing to note about the thing that will be relevant later on is this, that not all measurement contexts can be made deterministic by any non-contextual assignment of probabilities to the quotient spec or to that hypergraph. Okay, this will appear later. So now, logic for the colorable scenarios. For example, when you check KCBS, like 5 projectors, a special state. What are you assuming there? You're assuming that there are some operational equivalences between the measurements, that whether I measure it with this commuting observable or that one, it's the same, that the operational statistics doesn't change. You assume measurement non-contextuality, that I assign it the same response functions. You also assume outcome determinism. Now, assuming these 3 things does not give you a straightforward contradiction. What it gives you is an upper bound on the strength of some measurement-measurement correlations given on any input state that you can throw at the system, right? If you assume these 3 things, it gives you what you would call your quotient spec inequalities, or Bell quotient spec inequalities, or even CSW inequalities, right? They're the same thing. But the thing is, you can rewrite that as a contradiction. So you have this. Now, I'm just rewriting the previous thing, which is that you have these operational equivalences, you have these 2 assumptions, and now you're saying that the strength of the measurement-measurement correlations exceeds that upper bound that I earlier mentioned for at least 1 input state. I just need 1 choice of input state for which this is exceeded, and I get a contradiction. So this is, for example, how it works in Klyashko, where you have 5 projectors, so a special state that violates it maximally, for example. Not all states would violate that inequality in general. Okay? Now, so again, the contradiction disappears if outcome determinism is relaxed. If I relax outcome determinism, there's no problem achieving any general probabilistic model on a hypergraph. Okay? So again, KCBS, this is your example, works exactly the same way as in the case of the 18 ray proof. So a projector appears in 2 different bases. These are the operational grounds, if you assume quantum theory, for these to be operationally equivalent. Quotient spec and non-contextuality says that you sort of assign the same response functions, which are deterministic. And empirical adequacy further requires that this probability should be reproduced by this ontological model. One description should be consistent with the other description. Now, let the 0, 1 values assigned be labeled. So let's just call these W1, W2, 3, 4, 5. Okay? We are assigning values to these measurement outcomes. So normalization constraints, these are just the operational constraints that the probabilities for all states for a compatible, for orthogonal sort of projectors add up to less than or equal to 1, right? For all rho. So this you already have. Now, the KCBS inequality reads like this, that if you sum up the probabilities for these projectors for any input state, then that's in the ontological model, that description would look like this, a convex combination of this form. And these values cannot exceed 2, because if I assign a 1 here, I have to assign a 0 here, then a 1 here, and a 0 here. But then I cannot put a 1 here, so I can at most have like 2 value 1 assignments there, right? So that's your inequality. And convex mixture doesn't change that fact. So now we have measurement operational equivalences, measurement non-contextuality, outcome determinism, and the violation of that inequality jointly lead to a contradiction, which again is like your justification for the inequality usually, right? So you have to realize that both can be read as a contradiction, both flavors of proof. So the maximum violation appears for a particular choice of the input state for a given choice of those projectors. If outcome determinism is relaxed, we can have R equal to whatever the maximum value is, 2.5 here, and which is greater than 2 without a contradiction. If I'm not assuming outcome determinism, there's no contradiction with this value. I shouldn't be surprised if I'm not assuming outcome determinism. Okay? So on the there's always this talk of UO being a state-independent proof. It is state-independent, but it is quantum state-independent in the sense that it's the same logic as KCBS, because you have to look at correlations of measurements with one difference, that for a fixed choice of projectors, it turns out that this quantity that you compute is a constant number, and it's greater than the quotient spec and non-contextual bound for all choices of the input state. It's somewhere intermediate between, so for our purposes, they fall into the same category of proof as the Klyashko proof, okay? And so this is what I was trying to say, that the distinction we draw is between uncolorability-based proofs versus proofs where you need statistics because of colorability. And it does not correspond to the usual distinction between state-independent and state-dependent that is made in the literature, because UO is a state-independent proof in the literature, but it is based on a KS colorable scenario. So it is intermediate between KCBS and 18-ray in terms of, it's just from the quantum point of view, because it requires certain additional features of the measurements for it to be state-independent. Okay. Now, how does Speckin's notion recover quotient specker? So it's a meaningful operational generalization in this sense, that if you assume that your operational theory is quantum theory, and you further assume that the measurements of interest are projective measurements, you can in fact show this, that the assumption of preparation non-contextuality, given the fact that you're thinking about quantum theory and projective measurements, implies the quotient specker notion. Okay? This is a result in this paper by Matt Liefer and Owen Maroney, where they obtain a proof via maximal psi epistemicity. This is a proof, there's another more direct proof in my thesis, which I adapted from a proof that Rob had for a simpler case. So this can be shown, okay? That this is the logical relationship between these assumptions. So now, any proof of quotient specker contextuality is therefore a proof of preparation contextuality, but not conversely. Now, how does this notion, what does it give you? How does it extend quotient specker? So it extends quotient specker in the following sense. If the measurements are non-projective, let's say you're assuming quantum theory, but your measurements happen to be non-projective, then the quotient specker framework is not applicable because of that initial problem about trivial measurements that I mentioned. So this notion provides a proper extension to this case. In fact, all you need to do is read this paper of Rob in Foundations of Physics. It's probably his only paper in that journal. It tells you that if you believe your operational theory is quantum theory, then this is how you should think about non-contextuality if you don't want to worry about sharp versus unsharp, because it gives you a recipe for all kinds of measurements in quantum theory. Now, the framework can also have novel joint measurability structures, like the case where you have POVMs with pairwise compatibility but triplewise incompatibility, okay? That you don't have with projective measurements. So it allows for new experimental scenarios that you do not have in traditional Bell quotient specker setting. So in fact, this is a reference. In this paper, we showed that, in fact, you can realize any joint measurability structure. If you're given a hypergraph with some joint measurability relations, you can realize any of them given projective measurements, but not with PVMs, okay? Now, what we are going to do in this talk is that we don't want to presume operational quantum theory, and we want to show that it still provides noise robust criteria for contextuality. Okay, now we can go beyond the theorem, beyond the quotient specker theorem. So, as we observed, that if we don't assume outcome determinism, there's no contradiction, so there's nothing to be proved, right? But we introduce a notion called preparation non-contextuality. Can we leverage that to do something here? Because the point was that we wanted to derive contradictions with the assumption of non-contextuality in the ontological model. And we don't want to add additional features like outcome determinism, something else which can. So we extended our notion of non-contextuality, but at the same time, we abandoned outcome determinism. Okay, we're trading one for the other in things we think are reasonable ontological models, okay? Okay, so now the key idea is to focus on the operational features of the experiment that logically imply that you must assign deterministic outcomes to your measurements in your ontological model. So you don't want to assume it, you want to derive it from an assumption of non-contextuality, okay? And these are the features that correspond to what we call perfect source measurement correlations. Okay, so this is how it runs. Okay, let me just first describe the kinds of things we look at. So this is what you look at in traditional Bell quotient specker type experiments. You look at, you're given a bunch of compatible measurements, and you want to look at their statistics on a fixed input state. And you want to compute the correlations between these measurements given a fixed choice of input state. So that's like this kind of quantity. Right? We need one more kind of a quantity, which is about the role this quantity plays is essentially recovering those contradictions that you had in the quantum case for the operational case. Okay? So this quantity is called the source measurement correlations. And it essentially is a characterization of how noisy your measurements are, because So it asks that for every measurement event of interest, identify a source event that makes the measurement event as likely as possible. Okay, ideally it should make it perfectly predictable. So for example, in quantum theory, if you're thinking of a projector and you input an eigenstate to it, you get a deterministic outcome. Right? That's the ideal case, perfect predictability. But in general, you will not do that. You will have some POVM and some noisy state, and you will get some maximally likely, some maximum probability for, like, when you vary over the input states to that measurement event. So you will not have that property there. But let's just assume, for the sake of argument, that you do have source measurement correlations that are perfect. Okay, so this is where that will come. So we are now discussing the uncolorable kind of arguments. And these are arguments about bounds on these kinds of quantities, about source measurement correlations. Here, I don't need to care about measurement correlations, because I already know that if I look at those correlations, they are anyway like not consistent with, like, you know, Bell Cauchon-Specker notion of non-contextuality. So in fact, like, that's a useless thing to look at. What you need to look at is the source measurement correlations in this approach. Okay? So bounds on this quantity. So again, I've redrawn that hypergraph. I'm just being explicit about the operational equivalences. Like, if you just conjoin these, like, these nodes which share a yellow edge, you recover that original hypergraph. I'm just explicitly saying that these are operationally equivalent, and these operational equivalences need to be verified in an experiment if you're not assuming that you're modeling the experiment with projectors. Okay, so now operational equivalences between the sources. So this is the new element we introduced. We also want to talk about sources. And these sources are basically eigenstates. For example, in the case of quantum theory, in the ideal case of quantum theory, this is what they correspond to. The eigenstate corresponding to this projector is this outcome of this source setting. Okay? Each source, there are 9 source settings. Each source setting has 4 outcomes. They occur with some probabilities. And this outcome, the first outcome of the first source setting, matches with the first outcome of the first measurement setting. So we're looking at correlations between corresponding source events and measurement events. Okay? And this is what we can do. We can use the assumption of, we can use these operational equivalences between sources. So we are assuming that these sources are operationally equivalent, which means in the case of quantum theory, the ideal case, you mix every projector with like 1/4 probability, every eigenstate with 1/4 probability. You get the maximally mixed state on a 4-level system. And that's the same for all of them. And they're operationally equivalent in quantum theory very trivially. In a real, in an experiment where you're not assuming that, you have to verify this fact. Okay. So if you give me those operational equivalences, you give me preparation non-contextuality, which is the idea that the distribution of ontic states is the same for all 9 of these guys. And if you give me perfect source measurement correlations, which is this idea that the probability for a certain measurement event given a certain source event is exactly 1 when the labels match. So I've assumed a certain labeling which was already implicit in my definition. Okay. So if you give me those three facts, so these are operational facts. And this is an assumption on the ontological model. This is what you can test, and this is a hypothesis. These three together imply outcome determinism over the set of ontic states that are of interest in that experiment. Okay. So now we can recast that no-go theorem. So note that we had this implication from here to outcome determinism, right? So we replace the assumption of outcome determinism in the original statement of the Cauchon-Specker theorem with these three things. Okay. And now this is what it reads like. When I say operational equivalences, I mean the standard measurement operational equivalences and the source ones that I just mentioned. When I say non-contextuality, I mean measurement non-contextuality and preparation non-contextuality. And when I say perfect source measurement correlations, I mean this perfect matching between input states and output states. This is basically a characterization of the measurement event, like whether it makes any input perfectly predictable. A trivial POVM, if you recall, does not distinguish between different input states. Okay? So that's like just to give you an intuition for why we care about such a quantity. Okay? So now you can. So these three things together lead you to a contradiction. So this is a conjunction of two implications, this one and the previous one about how you obtain a Cauchon-Specker contradiction. So this leads you to a contradiction. And now this suggests a natural way to obtain a non-contextuality inequality, that if you assume this thing about your operational data and you impose preparation and measurement non-contextuality in the ontological model, then you must have imperfect source measurement correlations to avoid a contradiction. So that gives you the quantity that you're trying to bound. So this is just the average source measurement correlations. This delta is basically the idea that the labeling is the same. And you can average that with an arbitrary distribution. You can take it uniform or whatever you want, for all I such that this thing is equal to 1. And this quantity is between 0 and 1, and it's 1 if and only if the source measurement correlations are perfect for all I. Okay? It's defined in that manner. So now, if you remember, when I said that not all context can be made deterministic in a non-contextual assignment of probabilities to an uncolorable hypergraph. What that means is that, so this is the max probability for every context, okay? This is the largest probability you can assign to a context of the 9 contexts there, for example, right? So this cannot be 1 for all 9 contexts, right? The max probability cannot be 1 for all 9 contexts because there are no deterministic non-contextual assignments, right? So this thing is less than 1 for at least one of these terms. And so there is an argument to relate this to this upper bound. That's where we use all our assumptions of non-contextuality. I'm not repeating the argument here. But I gave you an intuition for why this is the appropriate quantity to bound. And the bound looks like this. So whenever, so for some choices of these distributions, there will be a non-trivial bound. And for some other choices, the bound will be trivial. It'll just be equal to 1. Okay? Because for example, if I just take it to be Qi as a point distribution over one context and 0 for all the others, then I can always make that context deterministic in some assignment. The structure of the hypergraph is such. Okay? So there's no non-trivial inequality then. In particular, if you assume that Qi is non-zero for all 9 contexts, then this quantity has to be less than 1 just from the fact of uncolorability because these guys are all less than 1. At least some of these guys are less than 1, right? So that gives you a simple inequality for that case. But it turns out that there are other choices of Qi where you support Qi on certain sets of subsets of the set of all measurement contexts, and you still get a non-trivial inequality. This was found by Anirudh Krishna in his MSc thesis for the particular example that Rob and I had in that paper that I initially mentioned. And he obtained it by like a brute force Fourier Motzkin elimination. But we have better intuitions for why this happens now. And in fact, you can obtain the inequalities from pretty neat graph theory arguments, which will be in this paper, which should be out next week, or at least one hopes. So the example in the 18-ray case, the inequality we wrote down was this. In the ideal quantum realization where you have perfect projectors, perfect eigenstates, this quantity is 1, right? So it's violated by the ideal quantum realization. But what if you don't have the ideal quantum realization? What if your implementation is noisy? How noisy can it be that you can still witness contextuality? That's what this inequality is saying, right? If your source measurement correlations are sufficiently high, if they're beyond 5-6 between the gap 5-6 and 1, then you have witness contextuality. So in that sense, it's noise robust because it allows for noisy implementations and still you're able to make inferences as long as your noise is sufficiently low about the existence of a non-contextual model or rather the lack of its existence. Okay. So for quotient packet colorable scenarios, so remember that in the previous scenario, we had only bounds on the source measurement correlations. Now we also need the measurement correlations because in the original proof, we did not have a straightforward contradiction. We needed a certain upper bound on the measurement correlations. So we need to take those into account. So now we'll have a trade-off between these two quantities, right? Because in traditional arguments, you only look at this quantity. You don't even think of this quantity, okay? So now, again, just recalling that argument, that contradiction for chaos-colorable scenarios. So now you introduce this quantity in that picture. Operational equivalence between sources, preparation non-contextuality, source measurement correlations, which are perfect, gives you outcome determinism exactly the way that I described earlier. It's the same logic. And you put that in the antecedent of that inference, like here. So now you have operational equivalences for measurements, for preparations, non-contextuality for preparations, for measurements. You have perfect source measurement correlations. And you have this fact that the measurement correlations exceed a certain number. Okay, that number is basically what you get from Quotient-Spekker type inequalities. If you have these things, then you have a contradiction, right? I've rewritten that contradiction in strictly operational terms. The difference between that previous formulation and this one is that there's only an assumption of non-contextuality. I agreed, it includes preparation non-contextuality because we think it's important and natural. On the other hand, we think outcome determinism is unnatural, so we don't include that. We in fact infer that from our assumption of non-contextuality. The inference doesn't go the other way usually. Okay, so it doesn't go the other way. The contradiction. And then now, similar to the previous case, I can again justify an inequality, which says that if I want to hold on to the operation, so operational equivalences I can verify. If I want to hold on to the assumption of non-contextuality, there must be a trade-off between these two quantities. Like it cannot be that this thing is 1 and this thing is also greater than this. So, you know, that there has to be some quantitative trade-off. And our job is to figure out what this trade-off is for an operational inequality. Okay? So robust KCBS. Now I'll just derive an inequality for that previous scenario, which was like a Quotient-Spekker scenario, where we had an upper bound of 2. Now I'll derive a different inequality. Recalling that in the quantum case, this was the quantity you were looking at, the sum of the probabilities of those projectors. We define this operational quantity. the corresponding operational quantity to be this. The source, the measurement correlation is given an input source event to that measurement device. And we sum over, so for various measurement events, like so here mi equals 0 given measurement setting, mi corresponds to, for example, in the ideal case, this projector. Okay? And for this input setting, it's just the same quantity operationally written. Okay? Of course, I have included a joint distribution here, so you can actually factorize this. You can take this here and write a probability of S star given S, okay, S star, which I take into account here. So, so where we are assuming that there are three outcome measurements, they satisfy operational equivalences of this form. So remember, in that hypergraph, you had three sort of outcomes. So I labeled them 0, 1, 2, and then 0, 1, 2. So the second outcome of this one is operationally equivalent to the 0th outcome of the next one. So that's the labeling here.
Sorry, what does S, the capital S means in context
of the
theatrical?
Capital. So the thing is that we need mixtures of states here. So which is why in a standard experiment you would just post select on a particular choice of that state. We are doing this with a mixture of states precisely because we want to employ our assumption of preparation non-contextuality, right, with respect to convex mixtures. So that's there. And so it's a slightly different experiment than what you might imagine. But the inequality derives from the same kind of contradiction that you have in the Cauchon-Speckert case. Okay?
Were you asking about the particular event, little s star?
This s star corresponds to your choice of that state psi that you have in standard Klyashko, which is
right.
It corresponds to that.
Small
s star given capital S star corresponds to that psi. And the psi is part of an ensemble where there are some other outcomes for capital S star, right? For example, just the orthogonal thing to it. So 1/3 of psi plus 2/3 of the orthogonal thing gives you the maximally mixed state in the quantum case, right? So it's that kind of a thing. So you imagine the ensemble is the maximally mixed state on a Q-trit. Right, so part of that ensemble is this psi, and the other part is the orthogonal part with some probability. Is that clear? Like,
it is, but the article is only violated for some, up to some degree of noise, right? So,
I'm going to go to that. So I'm just defining things. I'm just giving you what the operational equivalences I'm assuming are. They're for measurements. They're the same operational equivalences you assume in the standard Klyashko. I just need to tell you what the equivalences at the level of the sources are, right? And that's what I want to tell you because. So for every measurement event, so there are like, in all there are 10 measurement events, because if you include the extra, the orthogonal thing that you don't put in the inequality, then there are 10 events. For every event, I include a source event with respect to which I want to test its predictability of that measurement event, right? And these source events should satisfy certain operational equivalences. So there are 5 sources with 3 outcomes each. And I check the predictability of the corresponding measurement event on the corresponding source events. So that's the new feature here. That's the new thing that we are doing, right?
Note that here I've just divided
this by the probability of the fact that you get that psi that you need. So this is just that probability, and so this gives you the analog of the quantity that you have in the standard Klyashko. Okay, this is the same quantity. Now, so for sources, we have again 5 source settings. Each source has 3 possible outcomes. Sources are such that these operational equivalences are satisfied. So for each basis, there is a certain mixture that mixes to the maximally mixed state, is what we are assuming in the case of quantum theory. And we are also assuming that S star is such a source that I can take the special quantum state that violates the inequality and the orthogonal thing and their mixture, it produces a maximally mixed state. And that's operationally equivalent to these guys. Okay, this is where the constraint comes from, basically, because we're not assuming outcome determinism. We'll apply preparation non-contextuality to this thing to derive constraints. So is an additional special preparation setting so it needs at least 2 outcomes, like this S star, capital S star setting to apply preparation non-contextuality there. So now we define the source measurement correlations in exactly the same way we defined in the previous case, the uncolorable case. And we have an inequality, okay? So I haven't given you the argument how to derive the inequality, but it works it uses only the assumptions that I have mentioned in this talk so far, okay? There's nothing extra, okay? So this is a trade-off relation. This trade-off relation says that you can achieve some measurement correlations. You can achieve really strong measurement correlations for this particular source event, the special psi that you have in standard Klyoshko. But that must trade off against the source measurement correlations, which basically characterize your individual measurements. Remember, if you had projectors for every basis, I could take eigenstates to be my source events, and I have perfect predictability for that case. So in that case, this quantity would be 1. And I recover standard Klyoshko. But in general, that's not going to be the case, because your measurements are going to be POVMs, noisy, not perfectly computing, all those things, right? And that's the thing that would go into this term, because it would quantify how predictable can I make these things to justify the assumption of outcome determinism, which in turn gives me Klyoshko, right? So here, I'm not even using outcome determinism. I'm just using non-contextuality with these operational equivalences to give you an operational quantity rather than some hypothesis about the ontological model, right? Which is, in particular, the hypothesis of outcome determinism. I'm not giving you that. I'm giving you just non-contextuality, okay? So this is that trade-off. So now think of trivial POVMs, right? So first look at the ideal quantum case. For I from 1 to 5, you have these measurement events identified with projectors. The source event corresponding to the corresponding states. And the special event is this psi that you had in Klyoshko. And we have these operational equivalences between the source event. So this is the particular quantum realization. And so now you note that this perfect source measurement correlation. So if you've seen perfect source measurement correlations, then you should believe that the standard Klyoshko inequality is a good witness of non-classicality in this approach. Okay? And so if you've seen this and you see this, then you see that this trade-off relation is violated. Right? If you read it differently, it says that only if the source measurement correlations are perfect, you have operational grounds to believe that this non-contextuality inequality holds. It formally looks the same as Klyoshko, but we started with different assumptions. Okay, and there are different operational quantities that go into, like this is a special case when you have perfect source measurement correlations, which you never will in a real experiment. Okay, the sense in which trivial POVMs are not a problem for this inequality. So for example, if I took this inequality seriously, if I said that this is my Klyoshko inequality, this is what I'm going to stick to as my witness of non-classicality, then I can easily assign trivial POVMs to the 5 measurements. I can just take them to be identity by 2. And then this quantity will be half, because it's just insensitive to the input state. It'll always give you a half probability, right? And if that's the case, so this is the case, right? Like, so if everything is noisy, the source measurement correlations are half. This thing is 5 by 2 because it's all identity by 2. We're just adding those probabilities, and the non-contextuality inequality, this one, is trivially satisfied, because our inequality is different from the standard one. We're not saying that this thing is bounded by 2 anymore. We're saying that we're taking into account properties of the measurements, which are like the quality of measurements you've done, which is here. And so trivial POVMs are non-contextual in this approach, because this trade-off relation is not violated. It holds. Okay, and so this, if you see like a maximally Cauchy-Specker contextual box, like something that violates Klyoshko inequality maximally, you should not be surprised unless you have verified that the source measurement correlations were unbiased. You need like at least these to be at least greater than half for this to be a surprising thing, okay, in this approach. So if you were believing in outcome determinism, you would be surprised just right away, because if you see something greater than 2, you'd say, oh, this is non-classical, something is going on, right? But in this approach, that is not surprising unless you have verified that these source measurement correlations are perfect, unless this is 1. Okay? So there are operational grounds for believing in a Klyoshko type inequality rather than just a hypothesis about the ontological model, which has nothing to do with non-contextuality a priori in the traditional approach. In this approach, that hypothesis is derived rather than being a hypothesis from another hypothesis, which is preparation non-contextuality. Okay? So final remarks. What happens to the classical quantum GPT hierarchy in this approach, right? In the traditional approach, when you're thinking of the standard framework, CSW or AFLS, the hierarchy already collapses if POVMs are allowed, but since trivial POVMs, as I just showed you, can maximally violate the inequalities. In the particular case of Klyoshko, I showed you a trivial identity over 2 POVM, and those inequalities cannot make sense of that POVM. They would say it's a very non-classical POVM. But we know that it's a trivial POVM because it's insensitive to the state, the input state I throw at that POVM. It will respond the same way. It doesn't care. Right? It just throws away the system, it just gives you some distribution. Right? So intuitively we know it's a classical thing. Why should we be surprised? So this gives a quantitative meaning to that intuition that you have that trivial POVMs are really trivial, the source measurement correlations. Okay? So this is exactly what I was trying to say when I was saying that let's take this notion of non-contextuality seriously and see where it takes us. Does it take us somewhere interesting? And I'm trying to argue that it does take us somewhere interesting if you're only interested in the standard Bell quotient Speckert kind of arguments. Okay? Because it gives you reasons to believe your Kliashko inequality, operational grounds, rather than a hypothesis about outcome determinism. So in our approach, instead of this collapse of this hierarchy, which renders these approaches unsuitable, the previous approach, like the quotient Speckert, standard quotient Speckert approach, unsuitable for POVMs, we have a quantification of the trade-off between the quality of the measurements and the strength of the source of the measurement-measurement correlations in our inequalities. Okay? So therefore, in some sense, the hierarchy still obtains as long as your POVMs are not completely trivial. Right? It's just that the bounds shift a bit, depending on the noise. Okay? So this gives some quantitative meaning to that intuition we had that trivial POVMs are classical. So take away. So these are the two things we've been talking about. I've been talking about this one. And in the most general sense, the way these differ is this, that for the Bell quotient Speckert approach, the type of context is usually like an orthonormal basis, a projector appearing in different bases, or it's whether a joint a measurement commutes with certain other measurements, or whether it's jointly measurable with certain other measurements. Those are the notions of context. But remember, the way I defined the context was any distinction between operationally equivalent things. So we obviously have more notions of context than just the ones that are part of the quotient Speckert approach. Okay? So we generally think of more context. Assumptions. In the standard quotient Speckert approach, you assume measurement non-contextuality and outcome determinism. Jointly, they are basically the quotient Speckert non-contextuality assumption. Or at least you need to assume factorizability to make Samson happy. So in this approach, you assume measurement non-contextuality and preparation non-contextuality. And if you want to call that fact about representation of mixtures at the operational level agrees with the representation at the ontological level. That was a mathematical fact we've used. I'm not denying that. But whether that fact is an assumption on what grounds is justified, do you believe that the system influences my measurement choices or not? That's up to you. Like, I don't want to argue with that. I was just exploring the consequences of that assumption, okay? And I'm trying to argue that it takes us somewhere interesting. Okay. Quantity of interest, measurement correlations for a fixed input state. Here, we also include source measurement correlations because they tell you the quality of your measurements. Okay? Quantity of interest, types of inequalities are, in the case of colorable scenarios, there are constraints on measurement-measurement correlations, which are formally equivalent to the classical marginal problem. If you give me a bunch of distributions over different sets of observables, some of which overlap, then I ask you whether there exists a joint distribution for this thing. Then you obtain certain constraints on these marginal distributions. Those are your Bell quotient Speckert inequalities. Here, it's not formally equivalent to the classical marginal problem. It's more general, because if it was formally equivalent to the marginal problem, then you would just have the Kliashko inequality would be strictly satisfied. It's not it's not a legitimate inequality for non-contextuality in this approach, unless you have witnessed perfect source measurement correlations. Okay? So it's a more refined approach. We look at trade-off between measurement correlations and source measurement correlations. For uncolorability proofs, I argue that it's a logical contradiction. You don't need an inequality on measurement-measurement correlations to witness the fact that it's non-classical. It's always non-classical no matter what input state you throw on it, because all probabilistic models on that thing are outside the convex hull of deterministic models for the trivial reason that there are no deterministic models. Okay? So everything is non-classical on a if you're thinking of quotient Speckert non-contextuality on a KS uncolorable hypergraph. Okay? All distributions are non-classical in this approach. But we do need an inequality because we're looking also at sources. And we have a robust equality which bounds the source measurement correlations. So now we don't measurement correlations play no role because obviously everything is non-classical at that level in terms of quotient Speckert non-contextuality. So no measurement correlations needed. Essential reading. This is my PhD thesis. The first chapter is very nicely written. I spent some time writing it. If you want to read it, I'm just pitching it. It's on the archive. It was recommended by my referee, one of the referees, I think, who was somewhere in Oxford. Anyway, in conclusion, war is not the answer. Universal non-contextuality is. But if you still insist, I've got just the guy. Thank you.
Stop there. Based on first.
Yep.
What is the difference between your robots, non-context quality intelligence, and the non-context quality intelligence by Cedric Shmoo, the Russian Saka, and Maxim Pavlovsky?
Which one of those?
Yeah.
Oh, right. So they do it for the case of KCBS, and they do some sort of an optimization of between like this what I call the source measurement correlation and the measurement correlation given a fixed input state. So they optimize the coefficients and try to maximize that thing. So in terms of the derivation, it's slightly ad hoc. It obtains an inequality. It's not the same as this. The bounds are different, I think. And the other thing is that it doesn't generalize. It doesn't generalize to arbitrary scenarios. Okay, this approach, I gave you two examples, but it generalizes to arbitrary scenarios. I can give you inequalities for any scenario you want to throw at me. Okay, so that's the difference. So it's you could call it a generalization of that if you want. But it starts from a different argument, that logical contradiction thing.
Okay. Other questions or comments?
Okay. So I think that in your picture somehow this kind of true context duality is just Kochan-Specker, which original perspective has no actually classical polytope. Is there any connection to that? Because Kochan-Specker is the only thing that you don't have this internal thing, right?
Yeah, the uncolorable thing.
Yeah.
Because
in the others you can write down
the
convex set.
Yes.
So that is it so that this somehow is in correspondence with your picture that it really grasps the situation that when there is no classical set,
exactly.
No volume.
Exactly. That's why that was the first paper, because we had to realize that first to be able to go to the Kochan-Specker colorable case. Because note that it's formally equivalent to the standard marginal problem if you always had perfect source measurement correlations. You'll always obtain those inequalities in that limit. Okay, and then you can meaningfully define a polytope if you want and talk about it, right? In this approach. Like if you're thinking in terms of the traditional Bell Kochan-Specker reasoning, then you can, in this approach, it only makes sense to talk of the problem as a classical marginal problem if you've verified source measurement correlations for all the operational equivalences that I need. Because remember, I'm not assuming outcome determinism, so that's not my justification for the polytope. My polytope is not a convex hull of deterministic assignments because I'm not assuming deterministic assignments. A priori, whenever I use the word polytope, I mean what you call the no signaling or the no disturbance polytope. We're looking at the most general polytope, and then we are saying, without assuming determinism, if you're assuming like preparation non-contextuality, does that place any restrictions on the measurement correlations? And it does, subject to the fact that you've obtained certain source measurement correlations.
So the second question related to that. So obviously, so in your case, this is the only case that is truly context.
Mm-hmm.
So, but you and also.
No, the other cases are also truly.
Yeah, well, yes, but in a strong sense.
In a strong sense.
Yes. Whatever strong.
I won't call it truly, but okay, it's Bell Kochan-Specker sense. It agrees. It agrees with the traditional notion under those conditions. Yeah.
In you and all is not very far from Kochan-Specker in the sense that it has.
Which one? The uncolorable one or
this
colorable one?
That one is on the actual the black.
The 18 ray.
There's 13.
So
it's not far because it always has this situation when you cannot color two vertices, particular vertices, or three, four particular vertices.
Yes.
So my question is there any...
You have to pick a subset of those vertices to do that, right? The argument is for a subset of vertices.
Absolutely,
yes.
For a subset. So my question is there any signature
mm-hmm.
of that class here mm-hmm. in our picture? Because there should be some...
Yes, because so that's the distinction I was trying to draw when I said that, look, the distinction we are making is between what I call Kochan-Specker uncolorable hypergraphs, which correspond to like the classic Kochan-Specker 67 argument, or even Peres-Mohmann, and Kochan-Specker colorable hypergraphs, where you need to look at the statistics to infer that you exceed a certain bound to witness Kochan-Specker contextuality. And so I'm arguing that UO falls in that second class. It's state independent in the specific sense that if you provide, if you're assuming quantum theory and you throw all quantum states into it, it'll always give you the same violation of that bound, right? That's the sense in which it is state independent. It's not state independent in the strong sense that, in the Kochan-Specker 67 sense, that there are no probabilistic, there are no states in any GPT assigning you know, probabilities to this thing, right, such that that inequality would, some inequality. So do you see the distinction between the two things? Like,
right, so still Kliapsko is different.
It's different, but it is, the hypergraph for UO is as, it admits deterministic assignments. So you can have a convex hull there. You have a Bell quotient spectral polytope in that situation is what I'm trying to say.
Of course, yes.
Right? So mathematically it's the same situation as Kliashko for me because I don't care about the quantum distinctions.
So that's
right?
Actually a little subtle. I thought to see the two pictures of they're a little bit different. But I mean that's a matter of taste.
Okay. Yeah. I'm just saying given my definitions, that's the categorization classification I'm making. You can choose another classification, but this is the one that I'm making. Yeah.
Okay, and one more question.
And do you see any connection with Kujala and Larson's?
Yeah. Analysis? So let me comment on that. So the basic problem there is this. So in our language, what we'd call it is the problem of operational inequivalence between measurements. The idea that this implementation of this measurement, which I thought was the same as the other implementation of the same measurement, are not really the same because they differ at the level of statistics itself, right? Like the distributions differ depending on the context. No disturbance, strictly speaking, in your language doesn't hold. That's what you're trying to handle in that approach, right? And so the way we handle this in our approach is not at the level of theory. We have derived some inequalities, but we've assumed strict operational inequivalences. We've assumed perfect operational equivalences. So you can always say that, oh yeah, what happens when things are operationally inequivalent? And that's exactly what Mike's talk was about. The previous talk was about what do you do when operational equivalences don't hold, right? And so this is a different take on the same problem, which is, and here we don't only have to worry about operational inequivalences between measurements, we also have to worry about it for preparations, okay? In the standard approach, you only worry about for the measurements, but we also have to worry about preparations because we use features about the preparations, right? So we need to handle both of those things, and the principle for handling them is the same. And it's different from what you do in that approach. So they are different because what we do is we characterize the GPT, for example, you know, fit to a certain rank K model, and then you're assuming certain tomographic completeness, you're assuming convexity properties, and then you say, okay, I can infer secondary procedures instead of the ones that I implemented in the lab, which differed. I can infer from them secondary procedures in the convex hull, which satisfy the operational equivalences exactly. And therefore, for these procedures, I have reasons to apply my assumption of non-contextuality, and I derive my inequalities. If those inequalities happen to be violated by these procedures, I witness non-classicality. But somehow, if my original experiment was too noisy, was really bad, I didn't really go anywhere close to the projectors, then restoring these operational equivalences will not buy you anything because you restore them, you apply your analysis of non-contextuality, derive inequalities, but you will never violate them simply because your initial things were too noisy to violate them, right? So there is a price you pay for restoring this operational inequivalence to an equivalence in this approach using convexity and tomographic completeness. You, of course, don't appeal. So in Yanoke's approach, or Jafarov and Kujala, right? In that approach, you're not thinking of GPDs per se, right? You're just thinking of distributions and distances between distributions and when what's the probability that this variable in this context agrees with this variable in that other context. You're worried about those kinds of things. And I would say that there is a certain merit to it. And in fact, what I would like to understand is like how can I leverage that, for example? Currently the way we do these things, we don't need it, right? But I'm just wondering if it might help with something. But the thing is that those formulas are too complicated as Yanoke mentioned in his talk, right? So we have a different approach, but I'm open to the possibility that you may have you may come up with a more hybrid, a better way to handle these things. Maybe I can adapt it to the case of preparations. But that's just an open, wild open conjecture. I invite you to think about it if you want to think about it. But as it stands right now, everything that Mike mentioned in his talk, combined with everything that I mentioned in his talk, and in my talk, makes these inequalities experimentally testable in the sense that I mentioned in my title.
Okay, let's thank Kavi also for his good answer.